Birth, Volume 3, The Gathering, Chapter 34. "Colonel, are the ships in position?" asked Wes.
"Yes, General. The carriers have been in position for about 5 hours now," said the Colonel.
"I would assume the enemy knows they're in place, that they are about to die, wouldn't you?" asked Wes.
"They have not swept the ships with any sort of scan or radar, General. But I would assume they would have at least some optical equipment looking at them, sir," said the Colonel.
"Deploy the ships, Colonel," said Wes coldly.
"Lewis, talk to me. Are we good to deploy?" asked the Colonel, raising his voice over the background noise of the looking-glass aircraft.
"Colonel, I'm getting some serious wobble in the carrier signal from HARP. I think I've isolated it, and you're not going to like it," said Lewis, trying not to be too technical.
"Are we good to go or not, Mr. Lewis?" asked the Colonel again, with a measure of annoyance in his voice.
"Colonel, I believe the target world has energized at least 2 major HARP arrays of their own, and they are bouncing a live signal into our airspace, Colonel," said Lewis, just as loud in reply.
"What sort of signal, Lewis?" asked the Colonel.
"Sir, I distinctly heard some Elvis and some Patti LaBelle, but they were with that what sounded like an a cappella group, sir," said Lewis.
"Lewis, do you want to swim home? What the hell are you talking about?" barked the Colonel.
"Colonel, you allowed me to build a holographic remote imaging system, which I did. It uses the HARP signal to light up the space. 1 HARP signal. There are 2 HARP signals, which means the ionic gases in the upper atmosphere are getting a double dose of high-frequency energy from 2 different places. That's like striking a match in the dark to see if you have a gas leak. The salt in the wound is that they sent over a signal that makes it sound like they're having a party over there."
"Colonel, sir," said Lewis snidely.
"Launch your ships, Colonel," said Wes.
"Sir, I need to assess that launch the operation, damn it. I mean now, Colonel," said Wes with metal in his voice.
"Calm. Are we go for Operation Pile Driver? Send the launch orders now," commanded the Colonel.
"Roger, Colonel. Go for Pile Driver," said the airman at the communication station.
"Can that signal be jammed, Colonel?" asked Wes.
"Lewis, can the HARP signal be jammed?" asked the Colonel.
"We'd have to match their phase exactly and shift it 90 degrees to form destructive interference, Colonel.
It could be done, but there is no knowing how the upper atmosphere will react with all that opposing energy being beamed at it," said Lewis, not taking his eyes off the display.
"What's the worst case, Lewis?" asked the Colonel.
"Worst case? We might burn a couple of 747s out of the sky. That would be bad enough, wouldn't it?" said Lewis sarcastically.
"Damn it, Lewis. I need to see what's going on over there. Otherwise, we might as well all swim home. Can it be done or not?" yelled the Colonel.
"It would be like skeet shooting with an M60 machine gun, Colonel.
Yes, it can be done. But somebody somewhere is going to get hurt," said Lewis, raising his voice back at the Colonel.
"Colonel, calm here. They are deploying battlecraft now, sir," said the airman.
"It's about damn time," said Wes, gripping his hands in parade rest.
"Lewis, can you give me any images of that fight over there?" asked the Colonel, trying to sound like he was in command.
"It's not as clear as it was, Colonel, but I make out 3 formations about 100 miles apart," said Lewis.
"This operation will keep the ships out of the atmosphere, so they won't be able to maneuver like fighters, Colonel. Be careful, and make sure they target Site R twice. I want that place turned into an oven," said Wes, gritting his teeth.
"Calm. Confirm the double tap on Site R near Camp David," shouted the Colonel over the aisle to the airman.
"Roger that, Colonel," said the airman.
"Mr. Lewis, you need to keep me up to speed on what's happening over there. Tell me what you see," said the Colonel.
"I make 3 more formations about 5 miles long and about 2 miles deep. They are about 100 miles apart and still coming out of the carriers. The signal is too wobbly to make out individual ships, and I'm losing color distinction. There's no way of telling what's hot and cold, said Lewis, squinting at the screen at eye level just in front of him. Lewis, can you superimpose the pile driver flight plans into that hologram, said the colonel, moving directly behind his station seat. I think so. Do you have the passcode for the flight plan? Asked Lewis. Type in J#S21 up arrow, right arrow, X-ray, Foxtrot, Tango, 5-6, Romeo, Star, said the colonel. Yes, sir. Here we go. These yellow traces here are the flight plans for what looks like three target areas in North America. These loops here indicate the double tap on Site R. The closest they get is 180 miles from the surface. You can see these gold lines here go well into the greenish haze. That is where the two HAARP carriers are conflicting. I think this is an aurora, actually, said Lewis. You mean like Northern Lights? Asked the colonel. Yes, sir. Exactly, sir. The ions aren't close enough to react with one another as free radicals, so they produce light as they get rid of the extra energy, said Lewis. I didn't know you were such an expert on upper atmospheric chemistry. Well, look at it this way. The stargazers in Pennsylvania will get to see the lights in the sky before they join the other traitors, said the colonel, patting Lewis on the shoulder. You realize that these are dead weights that will take about 3 to 5 minutes to hit their target altitude, stated Lewis. You said 180 miles, Lewis, said the colonel. That is straight up. These will have to come in at a low angle to stay below Mach 8. If they get going faster than that, the explosion will not stay aloft, said Lewis. You can track the projectiles, right? Asked the colonel. Yes, sir, up until they enter this pea-green soup here, said Lewis, drawing circles near the screen with his finger. Clean it up as best you can. I want to see what is happening over there, said the colonel. I'm already doing the best I can, sir, said Lewis. Colonel, I'm picking up a transmission, shouted the airman excitedly from the communication station. It's not encrypted, sir. Put it on the speakers, airman, said the colonel, moving toward him. No, shouted Wes. Belay that order, airman. Take your headset off and hand it to me, hissed Wes, as he pushed the colonel out of the way and strode up to the airman's swivel chair. The airman opened his mouth slightly, as though someone had just drawn a knife on him. He locked eyes with the now cobalt eyes of General Morley and dragged the headset off his right ear and handed it aimlessly to him. Without putting the headset on, Wes placed the earpiece against his right ear and listened without moving his eyes. His lips closed to a flat, emotionless slit as General Bainbury's message to his troops was broadcast. At last, he had driven the spear of terror through the heart of the top marine who would not break. He inhaled through his nose deeply as if to savor the fear in his voice. "Oorah, indeed, General," he whispered as he handed the headset back to the airman. As you were, Colonel, Operation Pile Driver will continue as planned. Sir, it looks as though the cargo bay doors are closing, said Lewis, drawing Wes and the Colonel to his screen. See here? The white spots on the carriers are disappearing. I think that's the door. It looks like all the ships are out and getting into formations here, here, and you can barely see this one over here. I suppose it's a little hard to use retros to position in space, but you call that a flight formation? Asked Wes, pointing to the Firefly action on the screen. Calm. The operation calls for attack formation Gamma 7. Can you confirm with the flight commander? Shouted the colonel over the aisle to the airman. Roger that. I'm on it, said the airman, clearing his throat to regain his composure after the close encounter with Wes. Colonel, I can't see much detail with the stereo phasing this thing is doing, but it looks like a few ships over here and along this line have lost power, sir, said Lewis, using his laser pointer on the screen. Calm. "What the hell is going on over there?" shouted the colonel. "It's coming in now, sir. Hold on." "Say again." "I did not copy that," said the airman into his headset. "Give me what you have, airman," yelled the colonel. "They're losing pilots, sir," said the airman, pressing the earpiece with his right hand. "You mean they're dying? Ejecting? Details, airman," shouted the colonel. "No, sir. The ship-to-ship is working fine. Some of the pilots are no longer in their seats, sir," said the airman, relaying the flight commander's words exactly. "Give me that headset, airman," said the colonel, taking it from the airman. "Gus, Whitfield here in Looking Glass. What the hell is going on over there?" said the colonel, holding the headset to his ear with the mic close to his mouth. He shook his head slightly and balled his left hand into a fist. "We heard it too. But what the hell does that have to do with..." paused the colonel. "Hell, you say. Form up what you have. Just drop the fringe targets and stay on course. And Gus, don't forget to double-tap side R. General's orders. Give 'em hell, Gus." The colonel handed the headset back to the airman and walked slowly back to where Wes was standing still at parade rest, watching. "Do not speak, colonel. There are forces here you do not need to understand. Losses are expected in any battle," said Wes coldly. "You knew? You knew this would happen?" asked the colonel quietly, trying to keep the conversation between them and the close-quartered cabin. "We are dealing with powers older than the universe. I never said the stakes were not high." "Carry on, colonel," said Wes with a morbid calm. "Calm. Give the order to deploy. Launch Operation Pile Driver," yelled the colonel as he turned to face the same direction as Wes. "Roger, colonel." "Go for launch. Go for launch," said the airman into the headset as he saluted his comm screen like he was launching aircraft off the flight line. The sun was so low and distant in the southwestern sky that the Milky Way was already visible, tilted across the sky of the northern horizon. The aroma of his Rocky Patel could not mask the smell of three large totes of used transmission fluid strapped in place of the back four rows of seats in the 52-passenger tour bus provided by his lifelong secretary's husband. He insisted they come with him to Side R, if they could make it, and the two of them slept quietly above and behind him in two reclining seats as he opened the wind wing on the left of his seat a little wider. Abdullah chuckled to himself as he looked down at his custom cowboy boots on his feet crossed in front of him on the floor as the cruise control maintained their speed of 80 miles an hour. He had never driven a bus before, let alone on a freeway, that did not have a vehicle in sight in any direction for hours. The green sign said 65 miles to Nashville. The world was changing. The planet was changing. And he considered it a privilege to be able to be here, in the world he knew was destined to traverse the galaxy back to its origin. Most of the L.A. basin had already been evacuated out of fear of rogue waves, but the seas had been amazingly calm the last few weeks. The plasma leaping between worlds of phenomenally different potentials had destroyed a dozen of the world's oldest and most wicked cities. Tens of millions of people had been killed in the conflagrations, and billions more had disappeared as souls were divided according to their resonant frequency between the two planets. He recalled the childhood stories various religious teachers had told him about how the world would end. They talked about all kinds of supernatural things that he never took seriously. The good, the evil, the black and white sides of a sharp line drawn by some distant, unnamed, and unknowable heavenly being never made sense to him. He quickly accepted the knowledge that there was an all-powerful being out there, perhaps beyond the edge of the universe, beholding it and weeping over it from time to time. But he never believed for a minute that he would concern himself with the judgment of individual souls. Abdullah resolved many years ago with peace in his heart after he escaped the oil cartel that played its part in helping the global banks take the entire world hostage, that the judging was left up to each intelligence. The glimpses of the road ahead made it seem endless. With each little hill, the tour bus rolled over effortlessly. He took another draw on his sweet evening cigar and placed his hand back on the large wheel as the trail of smoke sought the vacuum of the wind wing. He reached with his right hand to take another sip of coffee, still warm in the stainless steel travel mug in the holder embedded in the driver's cockpit. "Are you ready for me to take over, Abdullah?" came the deep male voice from behind him. "Actually, I'm fine, Frank. My cigar will last until Nashville with no problem. I'll gladly let you tackle the Smoky Mountains for the night shift," said Abdullah. "That's fine. Smells a little like a shop back there, but it looks like we're going to make good mileage out of that old transmission fluid. We have about 250 gallons left. I figure it will get us at least another 2,000 miles or so." "Anything on the radio?" asked Frank. "I don't know. I wanted to let you both sleep. You can turn it on if you like," said Abdullah. "What's the point? There won't be any news anyway. Shelley hasn't broadcasted anything since they told us about the attack on Western Europe. Sounds like our boys gave them a run for their money," said Frank. "I've had some time to think about that over the last few hundred miles. We're not exactly adrift in space. Rather, there is a consensus we're headed out of the solar system. I haven't slept for weeks reading about it. I've been trying to feed Shelley the information so people know what to expect. But after all the information we know, and even the fringe ideas, I am truly at a loss," said Abdullah. "I still can't get over how few people there are," said Frank. "I'm with you, Habibi. The ancient words say the path to heaven is narrow, and few there be that find it," said Abdullah. "Honestly, I don't think most people even had an idea there was a path. They just hacked their way through life with a dull butter knife. Who in the hell knew this was going to happen anyway?" asked Frank. "The greatest mystery in the universe is still a mystery," said Abdullah, blowing smoke toward the side window. "Doesn't make a whole lot of sense, if you ask me. What kind of god puts a bunch of kids on the planet on the edge of space and lets them play with matches while keeping the purpose of life secret? That's not exactly a plan," said Frank, sitting down on the steps beside the driver's seat and rubbing his eyes. "Secrets are only truths buried in the sand by evil men, my friend," said Abdullah. "Ain't that the truth?" said Frank. "You missed the point, I think. God gave us everything. His enemy found every last plate and page and inspired his followers to chisel them beyond recognition, leaving only enough truth behind to lead men astray," said Abdullah. "Well, you know how kids are anyway. If you give them everything, they turn into little shits, and then they become presidents," said Frank. "It's not the inheritance, but the struggle that forms great men," said Abdullah. "That's what your TV lady says, Shelley LaSalle. That's her name. She says the same thing, sort of. I think she uses the word challenge," said Frank. "Well, if all goes well, you will meet her in person in a day or so," said Abdullah. "One thing I'll say for this new world, people are considerate. I mean, they don't leave their broken-down cars all over the road and trash everywhere. They're not scavengers like rats. They work together towards something common," said Frank. "Well, it's going to change the 80-20 rule, that's for sure," said Abdullah with a slight laugh to his voice. "I always wondered what it would be like to have a company with only people who would work like it was their company instead of worrying about the time clock." "Company. What the hell does that even mean anymore? Where does it go from here? What do you think?" asked Frank. "Moments, my friend. And if death finds us, it is of no consequence. We shall not taste it. but shall be changed in the twinkling of an eye," said Abdullah, blowing smoke through the tiny, perfectly round ring he had puffed in the middle of the sentence. "Ah, now there, you see, I don't get that whole everlasting life part," said Frank. "It's not so much everlasting life, but life everlasting, as opposed to sin and death everlasting. Ever hear the term, 'no rest for the wicked'?" asked Abdullah. "Yeah, sort of. Wicked or weary. Does it really make a difference?" responded Frank. "It comes from a place in the writings that say that a wicked man's soul is ever restless, driven like a wolf to find its next meal. Millionaires are driven to become billionaires. Billionaires are driven to be trillionaires, and perhaps to even rule the entire world. Never, ever to find rest," said Abdullah, letting his voice trail off. "Yeah, or die trying," said Frank, agreeing with him. "Or kill trying, for that matter. That's the whole point. The only man less afraid than the king is the man who plots to take his place," said Abdullah. "You would think with all that wealth, there should come a point when a man goes with his woman or his family to the beach or the mountains and leaves that rat race behind," said Frank. "It is not the fear of poverty, but the lust of the flesh and the pride of life that drive a person to gain the whole world at the cost of his own soul," said Abdullah. "Hey, I'm all for a man earning the fruit of his own labor," said Frank. "When a man sees that he can endlessly spend the fruit of other men's labors, he will show no restraint," said Abdullah. "Well, I'm glad you're not that way, Abdullah. Thank you for bringing us along," said Frank. Abdullah took a final draw on his cigar and flipped it out the wind wing and exhaled slowly before closing it. "That I was not so tempted, my friend. I see Nashville up ahead. Are you ready to take over?" "You bet. Take the Lebanon exit on the other side of the freeway and we'll trade out. You can get some sleep," said Frank. The bus rolled quietly as he took the I-840 exit and rolled east past Murfreesboro and onto I-40 eastbound toward Lebanon. The road was much flatter here, as the trip across the bottom of the Tennessee River Valley would lead to the foothills of the Smoky Mountains. The sun was nearly down, with the stars flooding across the sky and fading into the pinkish twilight far to the south. "Hey, correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't those lights up ahead?" asked Frank, standing up on the rubber-matted floor in front of the enormous dashboard. "I thought this area was powered by the TVA. I believe we reported they shut down months ago," said Abdullah. "We should stop there, at that station. Maybe they'll have running water," said Frank. "And toilets, let's not forget," said Abdullah, releasing the cruise control and letting the bus decelerate up the off-ramp. He turned the large wheel and guided the bus into the pilot station where the lights were on. No vehicles were present, but there were some people sitting and standing outside who gazed at the bus as he parked it and set the brake. He left the engine running, as the diesel engine used a mechanical fuel pump and would run without any electricity. Frank looked cautiously out the large front windshield at the family standing outside, looking at him. He pressed the button and opened the door and stepped out onto the concrete. "Hi there. We're from California and we're heading for Pennsylvania," he said, extending his hand to the man nearest him. He gripped it and they smiled at one another. "Is there any chance of running water and perhaps a working toilet?" asked Abdullah from the bottom step of the doorway of the bus. "We will, for another couple of hours. Then it's lights out. Saves those batteries, you know," said a man in denim overalls sitting on the picnic table to the side of the building. "You're the first light we've seen since leaving L.A. There are a few buildings with diesel generators, and we've been running off good old salad oil and used transmission fluid, like our bus here," said Frank. "We got by on that for weeks, but we got the solar panel banks to feed the lines directly. The inverters were a challenge, but we modified the IGBTs to make three-phase. We store the energy here and there instead of at the farm for a few hours of lights after dark. That way the occasional vehicle knows we're still alive and kicking, said the man. I want to continue our conversation, but you did say you had an operating toilet, asked Abdullah. It's inside, toward the back. Should be clean and tidy. The water treatment plant is downstream, and we run it using biogas generators. It can't handle the millions of gallons it used to, but it works for our tiny population, said the man. You have done really well here. If you will excuse me, I'm going to go wash my hands as well, said Frank. Frank and Abdullah returned a few minutes later, and the crowd had grown by a few more people. There were bicycles and skateboards and one electric motorcycle someone had ridden there while they were in the bathroom. I don't mind telling you, that's a load off my mind, said Frank, making everyone laugh out loud. You have done amazing things here. You know, there is a young man in a bunker back east who could help you with all this, said Abdullah. You mean Kyle? How do you think we got all this going? Shelley has been telling us Kyle's ideas for weeks as part of her technology update. Most of us are mechanics, electricians, and a few engineers who used to work at the nuclear plant up the road from here. We're waiting for a generator design like he built. He says there is energy from some other dimension, like electricity, that can do the same work, except it's clean and free, said a young woman standing beside the man in the overalls. This is Wanda. She's one of the engineers. I'm Fred Fleming, a recovering farmer, he said humorously. Recovering? Asked Abdullah, still shaking his hand. Yeah, well, we learned that plowing the ground up was actually killing it. I learned how to plant so that I didn't have to plow. Lets the soil stay alive, and we plant different crops in order so the critters that eat one plant don't get a chance to lay eggs, and the pests eat the critters instead of the plants. It's actually a Russian idea. It works, said Fred. I see what you mean by recovering, said Frank. You gentlemen heading for Site R? Asked Wanda. Yes, we are. Non-stop if we can do it, said Frank. Why do you ask? Said Abdullah. Take a look, said Wanda, reaching for a set of long binoculars and pointing up. What am I looking for? Asked Abdullah. There, just above the large W in the sky. Cassiopeia. Here, rest your elbows on my shoulders, said Wanda. Those are ships, aren't they? Asked Abdullah, gripping the binoculars. Oh, yeah. They've been there for a couple of hours already. Came across from the eastern horizon earlier today. I'm guessing they're about 12,000 miles out, which makes them large as hell. Shelley told us they were coming, so we've kept watching for them, she said. Kind of like a fishing lure, you know. I think they want us to see them, said Fred. The Desert Storm, said Abdullah. I served in Desert Storm, said Fred. The same effect, my friend. You see across the desert, and you know the storm can kill you and your animals. It waits there for hours, and sometimes days before turning on you. Your mind can break apart in that time, said Abdullah distantly, still looking through the binoculars. You guys should push on, said Wanda. Any of you want to come with us? Asked Frank. Nah, I don't reckon. We're already home. We'll pray for your safe journey, said Fred. I don't suppose you have fuel for a cigar lighter, would you? Said Abdullah. This is the last truck stop for 80 miles. I believe we do. Right this way. I'll show you where it is. On the house, said Fred, putting his weathered hand on Abdullah's shoulder. Frank woke his wife and guided her to the restrooms with showers so she could freshen up. They were given some instant coffee, refilled their container of water, and grabbed a box of cheese crackers for the road. They waved as Frank released the air brakes and pulled the gear shift into drive. The bus quietly rolled onto the empty road and accelerated up the on-ramp for the freeway headed toward Knoxville. The sunlight had fully disappeared from the sky, and without any sort of light pollution or clouds, the galaxy was bright and twinkling peacefully with energy. The bus had no problem climbing the gentle grade to Monterey and the first pass before entering the Upper Cumberland. Abdullah slept quietly a few rows back, with both seats reclined and the armrests raised. The headlights stayed on high beam and pierced deep into the pitch blackness without a highway light in sight. Frank's wife sat on the steps by him and sipped coffee quietly and looked hypnotically out into the night. "Hey," she said suddenly, pointing to a spot ahead in the road. "Stop the bus! Stop the bus!" "What the hell is that?" asked Frank. "Slow down, Frank. I think it's a person lying there in the road. Stop the bus, Frank. We have to see," she said, putting her hand on his shoulder. "What's going on?" asked Abdullah, now awake and standing at the top of the stairs in the bus. "We're stopping. There's somebody lying in the road. See there?" said Frank as he stopped the bus a few yards in front of the shape with the bus lights on it. He opened the door and his wife stepped down quickly and onto the highway. "Wait a second," he said, unbuckling his belt and hurrying to join her, to keep her safe. "Is he alive?" asked Abdullah from the doorway of the bus. "He's alive," she said. "I almost didn't see him. He's not exactly wearing safety orange, you know. It's not safe lying here in the freeway," said Frank. "I think it's a uniform. Help me roll him over on his back. Maybe we can get him to sit up," she said. "Ugh," grunted the young man. "Hey, take it easy, son. You're going to be okay. Where did you come from?" "It must be 20 miles to the next exit," said Frank. "Lieutenant James Jordan, 410-252-0020, said the young man, rubbing his head like he had a headache. "Are you hurt? Did you crash or something? Look, my name is Frank, and this is my wife, Lucy. You're in Tennessee. You're safe. Can you sit up?" asked Frank, putting his hands under the young man's shoulders. "Am I dead?" asked Jordan. "No, you're not dead, unless we are too," said Frank, putting his hands to his own chest and smiling. Lieutenant Jordan sat up and looked at their faces lit up brightly in the headlights of the bus. Within a few seconds, he appeared to be aware and put his hand out to shake Frank's. He gripped it weakly, and then he began to speak. "I didn't crash. I don't know what happened. I was strapped into the cockpit of a spaceship, and we were scanning the surface for transmissions of any kind. It's a standard defense protocol to look for anti-aircraft capabilities. We picked up this radio message from Mad Dog Bainberry, General Bainberry. We were about to wipe his men out. I was about to wipe his men out. I couldn't do it. I always wanted to fly in space, you know. I finally got my chance, and it was more awesome than I ever imagined, but I couldn't kill those men, all those innocent people. I wouldn't do it. So I was going to run, you know. I was going to just fly away, but the ship was programmed, and we had those beings with us. They were watching us, like they were forcing us, only they couldn't force us. They just left us no choice but to follow orders or be executed ourselves. I just let go of the controls and closed my eyes. I didn't care anymore. And then I woke up here on the road, looking up into the night sky," he said as his voice trailed off quietly. "I'm not sure what happened either, but you are here now. We're on the way to see the president. We have plenty of room. Come with us," said Abdullah. "Yes, get him into a seat. Are you thirsty? We have water and some juice. Come on, son. Let's get you up," said Lucy, reaching for him. "I got him, Mama. Let's get back on the bus and get going. I don't like being out here where they can see us," said Frank, pointing up to the sky. "They're coming. They're going to attack soon," said Jordan, getting to his feet slowly. "Hey, take it slow, son," said Frank. "Yeah, I've been weightless for days. I've never been so on the verge of puking for so long. It kind of wears you out, you know," said Jordan. "Not really. Well, once when I was younger. Jack Daniels. Long story," said Frank. Let's get rolling, Frank. We have more than 1,000 miles to go, said Abdullah, helping Frank steady the lieutenant up the stairs into the bus. Frank sat down in the driver's seat and pressed the button to close the door. He released the brake and put the transmission into drive, and within a minute the bus had resumed its speed. You keep your eyes open, Frank. There may be more of these young men out there. How would you like to miss the last bus for Camp David? Asked Lucy as she unscrewed the top off a bottle of apple juice and handed it to Jordan. You're right. I'll keep an eye out. Don't worry, said Frank. What else can you tell us about them? Who are they? Why are they doing this? Asked Abdullah. General Morley. He is the commander of the Earth's, and I mean the old Earth's, forces against you. He'll kill everyone if he has to. But he has another kind of purpose. I mean, I've been a pilot for 2 years, and I've always been taught to target precisely. No collateral damage. He wants to make you afraid. He says you're all terrorists, that you've stolen the world. And he wants you to all suicide out of fear, said Jordan. They're reaping souls, said Abdullah, like he was reading a distant book in his mind. Souls? What on earth do you mean, Abdullah? Asked Lucy. The frequencies. He wants us to lower our frequencies so that we fall to his world, said Abdullah, looking at her. Frequencies? Abdullah, we run a newspaper, not a New Age yoga clinic. Where is Jesus in all this? I just don't understand any of this, said Lucy, finally coming to grips with their plight. Jesus is one of us, yes? He's the only begotten in the flesh, but his mother was human, Mary. He's one of us. He didn't say much when he was here. In fact, you can read all his recorded words in about 45 minutes without really rushing through them. But everything he said was about mastering your own self. Don't fear, don't hate, forgive others, love yourself. Everything he taught hangs on those simple principles. As long as we keep our own frequency, our own vibrational level high, and don't drop into the dark levels of lust and hatred and fear, we will belong here. Like our friend Lieutenant Jordan here, he didn't fall to earth. He rose to earth, said Abdullah, putting his hands on her shoulders gently. Abdullah, you're the most brilliant and determined man I've ever known. If you believe this, then I'm with you. Welcome home, son, said Lucy. I never thought I'd say this, but it feels good to be on the ground again. Thank you, ma'am. My friends call me JJ, said Jordan. It's Lucy. JJ, you probably need some sleep after all that up there. We have a long drive still. Can you pilot a bus? She asked, smiling at him, putting her hand on his shoulder.